We're here. We're back with our little sangha discussing words and meanings and the Stoics. I think what it's really about is trying to find a method to understand what life is about for each person. And what's interesting is that there are so many approaches that one would think that it would be an interesting point of discussion, which it can become. But often it becomes a real point of contention. In fact, discussing these things with other people who are so-called experts usually is almost as difficult as discussing religion, diet, or sex. You know, I mean, they talk about the four subjects that are impossible to talk about, right? Politics, yeah. Religion, diet, and sex. I think we have to add a fifth subject, which is philosophical approach to life or the meaning of life.
Absolutely.
Because one of the things and one of the reasons why I have taken so long to start to offer these kind of classes, they're not really classes, these sessions, or even teach anything to do with Buddha Dharma, was because I always felt, in contrast to my own teacher, everybody was always telling me what's so right and what has to be done. And that didn't seem to me to be appropriate to the very essence of what the teaching and the principle was all about. On the flip side, I think there needs to be a certain discipline in which we do commit to something and we follow through with it. So the difficulty for me personally, you now get to know me, I think all of you know me very well, I'm very open with all of you. Sometimes when I hear people speaking about the Dharma in a way that doesn't make sense to me, reacting to it, rather than just thinking, okay, that's their approach. And this is something that we all have as human beings. The interesting thing is that how do we follow a path of truth and know that it's the right path, feel that it's the right path, and stick with it, which is what's important. So I'm going to go a little bit on a tangent here for a moment. This is why I emphasize to all of you so often practical application. If we have something that we cannot stick to, it's a waste of time almost. Now, many people would disagree with me on that, and perhaps I express it a little bit harshly. It's not exactly a waste of time, but it could be a distraction. Some people will say, well, that's just karma. We just go through the good, the bad, the ups and the downs. We just live through it, which makes sense, logical sense. And yet at the same time, I'm looking here at the screen door to my apartment. There's a screen door. And if I walk out and just push the screen door on the screen to open the door, the screen's going to break. Everybody understand what I mean? You have a wooden frame and you have a screen to protect from the bugs. And there's a handle to open the door. So I know there's a handle to open the door, but if I just push the door with the screen will just pop off, which means the screen door will open up and the bugs will come in. So I've completely destroyed the purpose of what the function of the screen was. Now, that's not a critical thing, but it is a distraction because that means I'll now have to attend to fixing the screen so that the bugs don't come in. Whereas if I just would have taken the time to open the door properly, which I knew already, I would have that time for something else. Does that make sense? When we're introduced to a kind of other philosophy, I don't want, but any X philosophy, and it makes a lot of sense. Oh, that sounds good. Oh yeah, and that exercise, and after the exercise, I feel really great and everything. But if it's a distraction, it's just like breaking the screen door. After we practice it for a certain period of time, we'll have to repair the screen door again so the bugs don't come in, only to find that that was a distraction. In both cases, when I open the screen door with the handle and when I push it on the screen, the door opens. But in one case, the door maintained its integrity and function as it was intended, as a barrier for insects, but allowing air to move into the apartment. In the other case, I've destroyed one of the functions or changed one of the functions, which is being a barrier to insects. And so I then have to take the time to repair that unless I want to offer my body up as a food for insects, which is also another way to look at it. So without judging it to be extreme and a mistake or an error, we can look at it and say, that was a distraction. Now, perhaps another way in a Buddha Dharma to apply it is to say that's an unwholesome act. Now, of course, breaking a screen door doesn't sound very unwholesome. It's a minor unwholesome act. But it's unwholesome in the sense that it requires more attention to attend to it afterwards than it would have done had we just followed what we knew was a handle to open the door. So when we're introduced to all these practices and all these exercises and all these philosophies, and I guarantee you, if you haven't already, and since we're all of an age where we already have discussions with our friends, we're past our 18, 19 years old when these kind of discussions start with intensity and passion with everybody, they're all going to have their opinions, like talking about different diets. I mean, diets are amazing today. So many different diets. And essentially, the only diet that is really good is the diet that works for you. And by works for you, it means it improves your body's function, which means it not only improves your physical function, but also improves your mental function. So if you go on a diet that helps you lose weight and you feel svelte and you feel very athletic and fit, but your mental attitude is just completely gone, then that's not a healthy diet. On the other hand, if you go on a diet that makes you feel good, eating chocolate chip ice cream every day, you know, you feel fantastic, you're happy every morning you wake up, but that's not a good diet because your spleen will go crazy and your trousers won't fit after a week, and et cetera. There has to be a balance, and it has to be a lucid, dynamic balance. Diet, also being the doctor of Chinese medicine, I am working with all those things, keto diets, Chinese diets, no raw diets, the detox diamond diet, all these different things. The real conclusion is that it has to be a fluid, flexible concept based in practical applications and repetibility. Getting back to where I jumped off on this little side thought. What your practice does is it has to let you be able to use it daily. And this is the beauty of what we're doing right now with the Stoics, because the Stoics are very practical people. The philosophy, from my personal point of view, does not go as deep as Buddha Dharma, but it certainly makes it very accessible at a very early stage. Sometimes with Buddha Dharma, it seems a little bit inaccessible. I'm sure you've all felt that, because I felt that too. It just seems a little bit, well, yeah, that's great for the Buddha to say, but I'm not a Buddha yet. I'm not awakened. So how do I become awakened? Oh, but if they're telling me we're all Buddhas. And yeah, but I don't feel like a Buddha. I mean, at this moment, I feel completely lost in my world. And so it becomes a little bit inaccessible to my ability to function. And so the Stoic approach is a much more practical approach. How we can define what's within our sphere of control and what's not within our sphere of control. And for example, let's go back to the screen door example. It's within my control of how I open the door. So if I open the door with the handle, the door opens smoothly. If I open the door by pushing on the screen, the door breaks. Now it's within my control with how to respond to, say, the door breaking, for example. I can get upset and go, oh my God, the door's just broken. Now I have to waste more time on that. Or I can say, well, the door is broken. Now I need to fix it. Or I can say, that's okay. Bugs get in and they can make a meal out of me. I can take any approach I want. That's all within my control. So the Stoics offer a particularly Epictetus. And it's important to recognize, by the way, that the different Greek philosophers, all under the same schools of philosophy, did have slightly different perspectives. So if you're interested in Stoicism, which I encourage you to be, because it's a wonderful philosophy, I encourage you to go and see and read the different Stoics, from Zeno, which goes way back, to Marcus Aurelius. Many people like to quote Marcus Aurelius because they think, oh my God, he was an emperor of the whole world, an emperor of Rome, and he was a Stoic, and he wrote the Meditations. And that is, in my opinion, because it fits very nicely into the modern world view of power, control, politics, and it can be married with philosophy. But when we read Marcus Aurelius more deeply, we can find some things that seem very different from Epictetus, who was his teacher. And so Epictetus takes a different approach, and Epictetus' teacher took a different approach. And there's also some crossover from different schools. Like some of the Stoics were influenced by Heraclitus, who was not a a Stoic, and also some were influenced by Pyrrhus, who was also another gymnosophist, a different kind of Greek. I'm not an expert in Greek philosophy, as you can tell, but there are many, many interesting teachers, particularly pre-Socratic. I'm not so fond of the philosophers after Socrates, including Plato. I don't find him so, although Plato gave us what we know of Socrates, and I think a lot of what Plato claims as his own is really Socrates' teaching. So he's more like a scribe than an actual philosopher, in my opinion. And Aristotle, in my opinion, caused the biggest schism in the mind-body concept, and that's maintained until this day, which is why we see this fight between religion and science. And as opposed to in the Asian philosophies, it's just one. There's just mind and body. And that goes back to our words two discourses ago about physics and metaphysics. Okay, so in the Asian philosophy, there's no separation between physics and metaphysics. You'll also find this actually very much in Sufi philosophy, which is about everything is one. Rumi and Omar Khayyam, who I love very much, and the whole experience of the dervish that was taken up very strongly in Turkey after absorbing it actually from Syria. I think its origin is in Syria and Iraq somewhere, the dervishes. But Turkey really defined the dervish Sufi approach. And the whole blend of the whirling, which is the trance and the movement, in the movement in the mind and the heart. So it's very important to take something that you can practice daily. And that goes back to my emphasis for all of you, the breathing emphasis, the questions, what is really happening here? The question, is this within my control? Is this not within my control? And these questions are all tools that need to be valid. You need to be able to work with them. If you can't work with them, it doesn't work. So some people will respond, well, yes, I tried the breathing, but that doesn't work for me. In fact, I had a discussion with my sister once, and she was very upset. I think I mentioned it a few discourses ago, and she has these issues. And I said, just try breathing. Well, that works for you, but it doesn't work for me, was her response. Well, have you tried it? Well, no, it doesn't work for me. And the thing is that these things are skills like anything, like penmanship, writing, or like music, or like speaking a language. One doesn't speak it right out of the gate. One has to actually practice it after a while. And as one gets good with it, one can use it. One can use the breathing, one can use the questioning. Yes, the questioning is easier than the breathing in some ways because it doesn't require us to do anything physical except in our mind. But also, it's not always as effective because our mind can play tricks on us. And this is one of the things that both the Greek philosophers, not only the Greeks, but also Buddha Dharma, but also modern philosophy talks about is how the mind can play tricks on one. So practical tools are very important. And today, what I'd like to do, we were going to talk about words, but I'd like to introduce another way of practical tools. Okay? So I'm going to type here in our chat box, and it's called the option method. And the option method, you'll be able to Google it. When you Google it, you'll find that there are two resources on the internet. One is the Option Institute, which is in Massachusetts, which was founded by two psychology professors who took the method and developed a whole school around it, a very good one, in fact, that offered a lot of relief for a lot of people, psychological therapy. And you'll find the other, which is from the origin, the man who really kind of created it, who passed away recently, who was really more of a also of a counselor, but more from a social counselor point of view, and helped a lot of people as well. And I can put those notes into the group chat so that you'll be able to find it. So it starts with the question of what? And that question refers to what am I unhappy about? Okay, what am I unhappy about? But happy is just a fill-in word. It can be anything. What is happening here? What is really happening here? That's the first question. Okay. The second question is why? Why am I unhappy about that? That's the option method. But for our purpose, we could say, why is this happening here? Okay. And the third question is, what if? What if I wouldn't be unhappy about this? Or what if I looked at what is happening here differently? Or what if that is not what is really happening here? So how does this approach help us as a practical tool? Okay. What am I unhappy about? Let's use from my recent experience. I'm unhappy about the fact that my recovery is taking longer than I had hoped it would be. Okay, that seems like a fair reason to be unhappy. Well, why am I unhappy about it? Well, I'm unhappy about it because I can't do the things I want. I can't move as fast as I want. I can't focus as much as I want to on other things. And most of all, I have pain. The pain interferes with my sleep. I don't get a good rest. I get irritable. So that's the why. The third question is, what if I wouldn't be unhappy about it? Well, that's an interesting question. What would change? Not much. I just wouldn't be unhappy about the fact that I'm not recovering as fast as I want. Does this sound familiar to any of you from anything we've encountered so far? It's very similar to basic Socratic dialogue. The basic Fine. Dialogue that Socrates used to use, and also in some ways, it's similar to Buddhist dialogue, Buddha Dharma dialogue in some of the monasteries, in some of the training, particularly in the Tibetan training and sometimes in the Zen training. So the questioning of what is occurring, why is it occurring, and what if? Now, the what if is kind of a confusing approach, because if I'm unhappy about something, it's easy to say, what if I wouldn't be unhappy? Well, let's say we start with the question, what is really happening here? That's our motto for our little sangha. Why is it really happening here? What would the what if be? The continuation of the what if in that case. What if, what would we then ask? Anybody want to offer an idea? Use your thinking brain, or your analytical brain, or your non-thinking brain.
I mean, continuing the question of what if I was not, I was happy about it?
No, it's confusing. When we're talking about therapy, it's easy. What am I unhappy about? Okay, I'm happy about I don't have $1 million. Silly little thing. Why am I unhappy about it? Why I'm unhappy about it is because if I had $1 million, I would be free and could do whatever I want, which is not true, but you can imagine. What would happen? What if I wouldn't be happy about not having $1 million? Well, I just wouldn't be happy and I'd live my life happy the way I am, hopefully. That's easy with the happy question. When we put in reality, what is really happening here? Okay, what's really happening here is there is a situation where I believe that having wealth will confer upon me a certain degree of satisfaction, contentment, and happiness. Why is it happening here? Well, it's happening here because so far I don't have wealth and I'm experiencing what I consider to be a lesser degree of contentment, satisfaction, and happiness because I can't acquire or I can't create or I can't develop the things that I want to because I don't have the resource. What if, and here comes a question, what if that wasn't what was really happening here? So that's our what if question. What if what we answered in question number one is not true? Does everybody follow me? Let's start simple. This is a very interesting, I think we're gonna evolve this discourse today into a very interesting exercise in a methodology. What is that color? I'm calling that color green. It's the color of the door in my flat. Why is it that color? Because everybody, we've all agreed that that shade of a fraction of light that matches other things, leaves and clothes and papers and whatever, we call green. What if we don't call that color green? What if it's not green? Okay, so the minute we ask the question, what if it's not real? What if it's not green? What happens is it opens our mind to possibilities of it being something else. Now, many people would respond to us and say, oh, that's silly. You know, you're just playing games in your mind. It's green. We all agree it's green. Why are you even asking that question? They're missing the whole point.
The point is to open our minds.
Yeah, to open our minds. So I'm looking at the door over the computer here, and I'm looking again and say, what if that isn't green? Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is, then what could it be? Well,
yeah,
it's something there. It's some kind of why. So the first question I could ask, one question I could ask myself would be, why do I even see it? How do I even see it? Well, that's interesting. There are no lights in the house, so, oh, it must come from sunlight. That means light must affect it. And yet I'm looking on the door, and there's some parts of it that are light green, and there are other parts that are darker green because there's shadows from other objects. And so there's a shading in the green. Well, why is there shading? There's shading because there's something blocking light. So right away, I understand that the effect of light in my ability to perceive the green or the color, whatever it is a factor in what it really is.